This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome family and friends, fans and fiends to the ninth edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I'm Benjamin Norris and this is a 16-week series where we're getting to know Australia's LGBTI influencers. Each week, we will sit down with those who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community. Today, our guest is an Australian politician. You may have seen him on, pretty much every daytime, nighttime talk show in Australia. There ain't no TV network that he hasn't been featured on. He is currently the elected representative of Goldstein and has been so since 2016. He was the policy director of the Institute of Public Affairs and subsequently he was the Human Rights Commissioner. He has been a champion when it came to his work with the Parliamentary Change of Marriage Equality. And finally, you may have even YouTubed this, but his emotional proposal to his partner in Parliament last year went absolutely viral. I would like to welcome you and welcome to today's guest, Tim Wilson.
It was one for the history books yesterday when an emotional Liberal MP, Tim Wilson, proposed on the floor of Parliament.
Ryan Patrick Bolger, will you marry me?
The campaign is not actually dealing with the real issue.
So let's bring in Liberal MP Tim Wilson. He joins us now live.
I've said everything I have to say on this issue and I make no plans to make any other comment. Encouraging people to enter into committed unions and relationships, and that's where it came from. Thank you, Benjamin.
You've basically been from door knocking, starting at your career really, to then being able to stand up in Parliament. Did you ever think that you would become this prolific?
Yes, because I have a lot of energy, and not the energy you get from a Starbucks cup of coffee, but something you get because it sits within you and you want to change the world. And the truth is I'm only just warming up. I've got a lot more in me, so watch out.
But it's one thing to want to be a politician, and it's another thing to be elected and to have the support of your fellow politicians and also the public.
Yep.
Was that something you just felt was going to come?
I always thought times would move with me because there are attitudinal and generational changes that come in terms of social issues, in terms of economic issues, in terms of everything, environment. And I always thought that the values that I broadly hold were in touch with a generation and that generation was going to move forward. But it doesn't mean it isn't without sacrifice. It doesn't mean it isn't without pushing boundaries and challenging people, because there are always people who like the way the world is today. They feel comfortable. They feel safe. They find joy in the status quo. And if you want to change the world, you've actually got to be prepared to stick your head up and out and sometimes nearly have it chopped off if you want to I've had a few of those, in order to get the outcome you seek.
Where did you grow up in Melbourne?
I grew up in, a few places, but for the most part sort of like from about the age of seven on the Mornington Peninsula, in a place called Mount Martha, which is probably one of the most spectacular places on earth after anywhere in the federal electorate of Goldstein.
Growing up in Mount Martha, though, looking back to when you were a child, what were you like growing up?
Well, what happened is until about the age of 12, I was probably not radically dissimilar to what I am now. I was happy, I was confident, and I was optimistic. And then I just watched my confidence erode because I just didn't know what place I had in the world. And, you know, I think it stalled things like my maturing it certainly directly smashed my confidence. And then really by the age of sort of 16, 17, even people had noticed around me that there was an issue, there was a problem. They couldn't necessarily diagnose it. And I wasn't prepared to confront it either. And so actually my school organized counseling to actually say, yeah, they did, to say, you know, what do you need? What is it? Are there things? Because – you know, my parents are divorced and they thought maybe that was part of it. Maybe it was to do with family issues. Maybe there were things unrevealed that they weren't aware of. So I spoke to a counsellor, but again, I didn't reveal anything to my counsellor about these things. I just sort of talked evasively around them. And it became enormously problematic because I got to the point where I talked through a lot of these issues, but I wasn't prepared to confront them with myself. And I remember actually the night I came out, and I actually went and watched football. And I remember watching the footy game and I just went, you know what, in the end, I'm more interested in the players than the score. And that was the bit where I went, that's it. Clearly this isn't going to change because, you know, you go through that, can I change? Can I live a lie? All those sorts of things. And I hope people don't feel that way today. And I certainly hope they don't feel that way today. But certainly I did. And I know a lot of other people before me did. And then I said, well, that's it, I've got to confront this. And so I came out at age 18 to my then best friend and person I was living with.
Well, it's a testing ground for then for you to go and take that to your parents. But, you know,
Well,
what was your relationship like with your parents? I mean, you said they got divorced.
Yep.
But individually, what was that relationship like growing up?
So I grew up until the age of 7 with both my parents, and they divorced, and I went and lived with my mother. That's where we went down to the Mornington Peninsula, and my father stayed up closer to town and sort of saw him, you know, like many kids, every second weekend. And my relationship was complex, as it is with every parent, but it was, you know, a completely loving environment and supportive environment. But my mum worked very hard. I grew up in pubs. My mum worked in pubs. And she would then do night work and those sorts of things because it's not a lucrative career. And so it was a complex relationship of her working a lot and us being very independent. And, you know, like with every child-parent relationship, it goes in waves depending on whether I cleaned my room.
What about your father?
My father, same, but it was just more distant.
Yeah,
because I only saw him every second weekend. And my siblings at points went live with my dad where I didn't. And so my relationship, I'm very much like my father, but yeah, it was never that same degree of proximity. Probably a bit more of a, I think these days an adult, it's actually a bit more of a professional relationship, still with, you know, love and everything, and that's not in any way diminish it, but I grew up allied to him rather than with him. And I think a lot of people would understand that, that sort of difference of a relationship.
And how's that relationship, what's that turned into now?
Oh, well, nothing. I mean, nothing more than an ordinary relationship, I think, is between a parent. But it just meant that I've actually had probably more of an adult relationship with my father than as a child, whereas my relationship with my mother is probably still more as a child than an adult, if that makes sense.
Well, I guess that's the environment.
I'm still mum's little boy versus dad, where I'm kind of this grown man, and he probably sees me. This is going to sound like a very wanky thing. So he probably sees me more on television than he did a lot of times as when I was growing up. And so you get that kind of strange dichotomy, or that it's a very different kind of relationship. And in no way am I suggesting they're not proud or loving or anything like that. They're both and many other things. But it's obviously a different relationship.
Granted, you are yourself, but does that sort of change the way that they interact with you in any way?
No, not really. I mean, my mother still wants to give me a clip over the ear most days. And it just means that my dad, I think, probably finds it a bit funny because, you know, I think it's true of anyone who's a parent when people talk about their child when the child is not present and it's to do with things that they may not be aware of. And, you know, he started hearing from some of his friends, like, oh, no, I really like what Tim did about blah, and they have to then go and investigate. And that's true of anybody, I think, who's sort of broadly in the public square, and particularly one environment where, you know, politics draws harsh opinions. And so they're unsurprisingly sometimes concerned about my welfare and whether I'm coping. And so they reach out sometimes and make sure that I am.
Can you tell me something that your mum's wanted to clip you over the ear for?
Oh, you know, firstly, I'll never be as respectful as my mother wants to be, and I probably shouldn't go any further than that.
Come on. No, we're sitting here now. Come on, there's got to be something over time that you can give us.
Oh, there's probably so many things.
I want to know, Tim Wilson gets the phone call from his mum and...
I haven't been called Timothy Robert Wilson for a long time, so, you know, she just... relationships change, and sometimes I'm quite sure she'd like to clip me over the ear as a way of just reminding her who's actually in charge. But there's nothing untoward. It's, you know, as a kid, it was mostly about cleaning my room.
And as a politician?
Oh, no, I think my mum actually pretty much agrees with everything. I just think, you know, people, it's not just an investment in you as a person. There's a lot of emotional investment from parents in kids. And they see you doing very risky things sometimes. And I have done extremely risky things. And they sometimes say, you know, are you sure you're doing the right thing? And I say, yes, trust me, it's going to pay off. And I don't know it's going to pay off. It's just if I don't believe it, then no one else is going to believe it. And, you know, the classic example was when I resigned as Human Rights Commissioner, one of the best jobs in the country, not to get into Parliament, but just the chance to get into Parliament. Because in the wonderful electorate of Goldstein, generally the person who holds the Liberal endorsement then goes on and gets elected. And it was a very crowded competition. The truth was people were saying I was going to lose. And they're saying you've resigned this magnificent job with this great career path for a very risky proposition. And I just say, yes, I have to do this because I'd rather run and lose than never run at all. I have to, in part, I want to do this, but I also need to get out of my system. And then if I get out of my system, I lose, I can move on. And they were sort of like, this is risky. You know, you really probably shouldn't be doing this. But it worked and it paid off.
It paid off.
And the same was true in a lot of the marriage equality debate. People were saying, look, you know, you're putting a lot of investment in this politically. How's the electorate feel? If this doesn't work out, it's not going to be good. And obviously, it worked out as well. And I'm a bit of a risk taker. I don't mind risk because there is a bit of those who dare win.
What about your relationship with your siblings?
Yes.
What's the dynamic that you play amongst them?
I don't really know. I mean, my sister lives a fair way away from me, and so I see her a couple of times a year with her nieces. My brother I see a bit more often. He lives closer into town and he's sort of quite politically active as well. I guess the main role I play with my brother is one of frustration because he was involved in politics like I was involved in politics. We're both on the same side. We got involved quite independently of each other. But when your brother's elected to the federal parliament, it doesn't matter what he does. Everything he does is interpreted as being on my behalf, even though it's almost never the case. And so he finds my election both or service good, but in suffocating, I think, because it means he has to think about what he does and what impact has on me as much as what he does and how it impacts on him.
But looking at the dynamics of that, was there a role that you played amongst those two?
The truth was my brother and sister ganged up against me.
Oh, this is what you think.
No, that's absolutely what happened, and they would concede that. I was kind of like the black sheep by comparison. I guess it taught me the importance of numbers early on and how to count numbers. Two versus one, you're losing.
Yeah.
But that's what happened. But I don't know, because we lived quite independent childhoods. My brother went and lived with my dad, I think it was in year nine, so sort of that at that particular age where you're sort of, you know, really coming into your own. And my sister and I think it'd be fair to say, sometimes had disagreements when we were children. And so we actually lived quite independent lives from each other. My mum was working the whole time, so we were always doing our own thing. You know, I used to cook my own dinner. I used to make I'm not trying to embellish and make it sound like I'd bring out a violin, but we really did most things independently of each other.
What about what your parents taught you? And independently, what do you think that they gave you?
Well, they gave a good value set. I mean, firstly, my parents work incredibly hard. And so they taught me to work very hard and that there was not just sort of a joy in work, but there was a pride in work and particularly to be self-reliant and to stand on your own two feet. And then in addition to that, they and obviously independence, which was a very critical part of that. But they also taught me never to judge other people and to work with people because you never know anybody's circumstance. And I have a very strong view, and I never judge people's families, for instance, because firstly, you don't know the history and it's often very patchy. But now there is dignity in every person, and everybody's had different tracks to get to where they are, and sometimes they haven't been easy. And so you just have to respect everybody. You have to, and that should be the anchor of how you approach the world. It doesn't mean you can't disagree. It doesn't mean sometimes you can raise your eyebrow occasionally and question what people are doing, but you have to at least start with a basic sense of decency and respect.
Talking to people throughout this series, I've talked about the differences of what you were like as a child and how that may have changed as you discovered your sexuality.
Yep.
Would you say that your sexuality changed who you are as a person in any way?
Yes and no. I don't think I think I'm sort of the same person before I realised my sexual orientation. I think it, you know, you can pretend otherwise, but dealing with the challenges of being gay or lesbian or trans, obviously it's a gender identity issue, but you're forced to confront difference, which you may not otherwise occur, I think it does naturally lead you to become more empathetic towards people who are dealing with marginalisation or difficulties in their lives. But it also builds, I think, and the challenges for those who, I guess, say, don't survive going through coming out and everything else, and unfortunately, tragically, there will always be some. It teaches us resilience and coping mechanisms. And I look at, you know, how I deal with the world in a public sphere where you can pick up Twitter any single day and read what some people think of you. It actually teaches you coping mechanisms about how to engage with the world and how to manage what people think and realise what you have to value or take consideration of or not. So, yeah, it's influenced me, but at the heart of who I am are actually the values really that my parents taught me.
I think, you know, already as we're talking about your life, you see the building blocks to why you're this person. Do you think in any way that your sexuality has ever held you back?
No, it's actually, the truth has been a huge asset. It's one of the hardest things in public life is to find a point of differentiation which helps you stand out. And so if you were to look at it at sort of a more objective level, you'd say it's a brand differentiation, it's a product differentiation. I was probably one of the first major people on the right of politics who came out. I came out, there was obviously privately, but actually to do it publicly, there are very few people who had done it when I had done it. And I saw it as, firstly, enormously liberating, but then it gives you this, as I said, brand differentiation. And I think it's largely helped me. I mean, it doesn't mean that people don't try and use these things to tear you down. They do. But I think they've always been much less potent than people think. I think most Australians take a pretty live and let live attitude and, you're broadly judging your merits. There'll always be people who will be snipey. But I think it's actually been enormously advantageous.
I think comparatively, you look at what people might have said to you on social media or in comment of your life, you know, people probably haven't really made that much of a comment about your sexuality versus your politics at times.
Sometimes they do. Sometimes they do. Rarely, I do concede that, but mostly it's about politics. But, or, you know, then people have a go at you about lots of other trivialities which you've just got to dismiss. One of the great coping mechanisms I developed many years ago was that I only absorbed criticism if it was from somebody that I respected. Because somebody you respect says something very harsh, you've got to absorb it. But the other flip side as well is if somebody criticises you and you don't respect them, you know, you've got to question, well, why is it that I'm absorbing their pain or their vitriol? And then sometimes it's quite a useful coping mechanism when somebody comes up to you and says something really nasty to you, to your face, which admittedly most people won't do.
They like to sit behind keyboards.
Yeah. But it's the politest thing you can say is it's okay, you're welcome to say it because I only absorb things from people who I respect, which is the polite way of saying I don't respect you. And so it's slapping them down in the process.
What about your parents? You know, we sort of touched on this before, but sometimes the biggest critics that we worry about what they will think, you know, when you came out to both of your parents, how did they cope with your sexuality?
Look, I don't want to break confidences, but my mum was fine. There was no issues there. My dad is actually interesting because I kind of went from the easiest person not to tell, which is my best friend, to the hardest person, which was my dad. You know, I don't know why I did that, but I did. And I wasn't quite sure how he was going to react. And it's interesting when you talk to them later about it, they basically said, look, we probably always knew, but, you know, we weren't sure and, you know, there's a bit of, not in a rude way probably, a bit of, you know, hope that this wasn't the case because, you know, parents have a very linear view broadly about how your life's going to progress. But again, I mean, it was 20 years ago. This is my 20th year of being out. How about that? I'm going to have a party.
We're going to celebrate with a marriage.
Well, that's true. But on the 10th year of me coming out, I actually had a 10-year coming out party because, like,
you did not. This,
I did. It was awesome, by the way. It was a
thanks
great
for the
party.
Invite.
I don't know if I knew then, but it was genuinely a party because, like, this is the first 10 years of my life where I'm living me. And I actually think people should do it more often because it was fun and it was kind of a really great celebration because you could watch where your life had gone and how much better it was, and it was better. And so when I came out 20 years ago, which I completely acknowledge, and a lot of people had a lot harder than me before that. I'm not trying to pretend even for a second. But, you know, the world was a different place. The only people still on television who were gay were probably probably dying age patients and funny uncles. We were still kind of in that time or the end of that time. You know, Will and Grace I don't think had come yet.
No.
None of that stuff. And so it was really kind of about proximity. If you knew somebody who was gay and they were having a happy life, you probably thought everything was okay. But if you didn't, it was this, you know, kind of still weird thing. And, you know, your parents went through, it was kind of still in that phase of, oh, well, you'll live a lonely life or you may not ever find somebody else or will you find love? And, you know, obviously there was the health, you know, and the legacy of AIDS and all that sort of stuff. And so there was this paranoia and, you know, where is, you know, are you going to get fired from jobs? And now, of course, all that's just rubbish and now, but at least the fear of it wasn't. And there were certainly things that had happened within very close living memory where people were still victimized or marginalized at a legal end as well as a cultural end and a social end. And so I'd understand why they were concerned. And, you know, there are concerns about, like, well, what would other people think? You know, well, you know, ex, you know, son, you know, he's one of those. And there was still a bit of that as well. The world was actually still a much smaller place.
My dad believed that.
When did you come out?
Well, my dad believed that he knew about my sexuality at a really young age. And it was funny. He then thought, he was worried about how I was going to cope with it. So he took me to a whole bunch of restaurants where he knew really gay waiters and spoke about gay people really highly. Oh, this is my favorite restaurant to go to. I love gay waiters. And all it made me think of, or made me question his sexuality. It didn't really made me feel any more comfortable to it.
Yeah.
But sort of touching on that, though, your dad obviously was just supportive then.
It took a while, but he absolutely got there. And he wasn't in any way hostile. It was just kind of an accommodation and just, you know, dealing with it. But I've had conversations since where, you know, they had conversations apparently when I was like two about this.
Really?
Yeah. And so obviously, I mean, I always as a kid liked to dance. And let's face it, nothing's really changed, just whether I have a platform or not. But you know, when you're a kid and you can dance in front of your parents and nobody's paying attention. And I do go back and look at a lot of the old family photos. And I was very often dressed in pink and blue. And it's funny because that's the colours that I generally wear today.
But that's, you know, it's so funny though because you do gravitate towards some things like colour. I wanted a Barbie.
Did you? Yeah. I never see. My partner had dolls when he was a kid. I didn't. I was like, I liked to play Indiana Jones. That's how we played in our household. Or, you know, I was Star Wars. I had G.I. Joes. No, I was completely, if you know, put in the sort of masculine trait in that sense. The only thing was I liked to dance and occasionally liked an audience. How about that?
You still do?
Well, yes, I do.
From adolescence to then your education, you went to Monash University.
Yes.
What did you study?
I first started studying a Bachelor of Fine Arts majoring in painting.
Well, I wonder what you'd been like if you went into painting.
Well, so it was a consequence of a coping mechanism when I was in high school. My confidence just collapsed in year 12, like collapsed. And I went from kind of being an A student or B plus student to barely really being able to keep my mind in order. But I knew that I was good at painting. But I knew that was it, and so I pitched that way to get into university. I actually thought I was going to TAFE but got accepted into university. Woo. And started painting. And actually getting into fine arts is very difficult because it's all folio-based. It's not based on a score. So you've either got it or you haven't. And got in, and it was 1998, and the teacher came in one day and said, you know, oh, that's it. John Howard's just been re-elected. And so you've got a GST, so all your art supplies are going to go up by 10%. And I actually got up because I'd actually looked at this and said, I'm sorry, that's not actually right. In fact, I think, I can't remember what it was, but the wholesale sales tax, the previous tax, was like, I think, 30% on art supplies. They're actually all going to go down. And we got into this heated argument, and I'd always wanted to do politics, but part of the reason I didn't was because of how I was suppressing who I was because of my sexuality, and realized, actually, this is what I enjoy doing. And it's not arguing, but it's standing up for what you believe in and trying to...
So you're telling me that an art teacher is responsible for unleashing Tim Wilson on Australia?
Yeah, for saying something stupid. Well, it brought it out of me. And it made me realize that I probably wasn't studying the right thing. So what we did in the second semester of that year is I studied, like, I think it was international relations. I went and did like one subject in arts, and in comparison to how I was doing in fine art, which was kind of trying to meander my way through it, I was gunning it over there, and I realised that's where I belong, that's what I want to do. Still had no idea that I was just going to get in Parliament, and that wasn't actually the objective, but it was, this is what interests me, and you've got to do what you love.
And from that course of university, how do you get from doing that to your first step into politics?
So once I switched over to arts, I was a waiter at the time and happened to bump into this bloke one night while I was washing glasses, who was telling, and he was asking me what I was doing. I said, I'm studying, you know, arts and doing public policy and politics. And he said, well, my son's a member of parliament. Do you want to go and volunteer in his office? And the truth was, it was, I worked in a wedding reception center. And so if anyone's done that, there's a whole load of work up until Christmas, and then bang,
gone.
On Christmas Day, it's gone until like the end of, well, the middle of January. And so I said, yeah, I'll go and do this because it'll keep me busy and stop me spending money, which it did. And, you know, rather than going to the movies and that sort of thing. And then what actually happened was volunteered for, I think it was only about 3 months, then uni started and everything. And the person who was in the job that I was kind of helping quit, and I was already trained up. And they said, well, do you want it? And so that then led me to working in politics. But that's kind of where it came from. But it got me energized and, you know, involved in, you know, the Liberal Party. It got me involved in working in politics, and I learned an enormous amount. I got a really good apprenticeship in terms of politics and how to manage in a way that served me very well.
I think it's really interesting that that's sort of where you cut your teeth. But also what I found interesting about your career is that the first time that you ran for deputy mayor, which was quite a few years later, and that you lost, to me it felt like that was a really good experience for you because it showed determination for you. You know, I think in a lot of ways it's good for us to fail.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that?
So I ran for Deputy Lord Mayor in 2008. It was when Robert Doyle got elected. And it wasn't clear who was going to get elected, and I ran with a bloke called Peter McMullen, who's still a friend of mine. And he was an old family friend, actually. And he wanted someone different, and so he said, and I was looking to run in the council elections, and so he asked, and he heard through numerous routes and thought I was a bit different and new. And so, but it was brutal, because particularly when you're running as somebody second, meaning their deputy, you don't get to set the agenda. And I thought, look, this could be a slipstream to success as one way of doing it. But then we lost, and we didn't lose badly. In fact, I think we came third, if I recall correctly, and our preferences got Robert Doyle elected. I know he's presently a controversial figure, but he wasn't back then. And I'm still waiting to see what's going to come out of that, but I'll leave that alone. I remember the night that the result was announced, and like they were all saying, you know, don't go to the announcement because we've lost. And I said, no, I need to go because I need to confront this. And it was brutal. I kind of, you know, needed the next morning a bit of time to get out of bed. And
yeah, what did it do to you?
Well, it kind of, actually what it taught me was a lot about my friends. Because the thing about success is when you're successful, you have a lot of people following you. You know, and I'm not saying that's insincere, but, you know, there's reasons why they want to hang around you beyond just because you're charming and good looking.
Oh, please, spare me.
And what happens when you fail is you turn around and you see who's still there.
Yeah, very true.
And, of course, the number diminishes quite, and sometimes quite rapidly. And I don't hold it against people. I mean, sometimes people don't want to go to parties that aren't exactly, you know, joyous occasions, but your real friends are there for you. And that was actually the time when Ryan and I started going out, because we'd sort of been, you know, semi-going out. And when I lost, he was there, and he was there, and was like, okay, he's prepared to be with me when I'm successful and when I'm defeated. That's a pretty good sign. And that's actually the main benefit out of it was not actually anything to do with politics. It was mainly
that your partner didn't leave you.
Well, we'd been on and off kind of going out, but it wasn't anything serious. And it was the message to me, which I took out of it, which is, you know, he's there for me, and maybe I should probably be putting a bit more focus on this thing, which has now led, of course, to a journey which has taken us to where we are.
Well, he's a lovely man, so I think it's good that you guys are still together and he supported you. How did you get to be employed by the Institute of Public Affairs?
Now, what order does this all go in? So in 2006, I finished some contract work. It ended, and I had this terrible life moment. Again, one of these things you learn from, where I was unemployed, although it was only, you know, a couple of weeks. I got evicted basically from where I was living because somebody was selling the house that we were living in. So I was essentially unemployed. And there was this massive housing crunch in Melbourne at the time, so you couldn't get an apartment. And so I was basically homeless, you know, with stuff in storage, that sort of thing. And then I got hit with glandular fever. And so I got sick, or very sick, homeless and unemployed at the same time. And so it was one of those real low points in life. And you're sort of like, how the hell am I going to get out of this, while you're trying to sort of stop sweating and actually getting yourself out of bed and watching whatever cash balance you have rapidly diminish. And they sort of gave me a contract to give me a go and actually to help me, because I had friends who were there. And it led then to going in and proving that I was obviously capable of doing more than just a bit of short-term work and going and working there full-time. And so it was a great opportunity, and they helped me at a very difficult stage of life. But it was also a great job. I mean, it was a great organisation to work for.
You served as the Director of Climate Change Policy and Intellectual Property and Free Trade. What are the wins in that role?
Well, when you're working in a think tank or you're working in public debate, you rarely have wins. You just get to have discussions. But there are lots of really topical issues that came up in my time around intellectual property and some of them very esoteric around intellectual property and renewable technologies, where I was very strong on the need to protect intellectual property so that we have more investment in renewable energy. And we had the big debate around plain packaging of tobacco products, which I was very active on because I didn't agree with the policy that the then government introduced. Climate change policy around the then emissions trading scheme. I'm trying to think. Trade kind of was a strange space because it had gone from being this big thing in the early 2000s, in that period where we were debating whether we should have globalization. You may remember that a lot of people will find the idea that we debated that very weird, but it was, to then kind of becoming a bit more settled. But there are lots of free trade negotiations and things. So it sort of involved lots of really contentious and sometimes difficult debates. And some of them were amongst policymakers rather than in public. But I kind of built a reputation as the person who was prepared to stand up and say what they thought, even if it was deeply unpopular, and very proud of that, and still kind of take that view, because it's those sorts of skills which then lead you to stand up on other things and mean that you're not just going to do what people want to hear.
Was that the first time or the first era, really, of you having an opinion that set people apart?
Probably in the public square, yes, because I hadn't really had a platform before. And, you know, people drew very strong views, but half of public debate is not actually about what you say, it's how you say it and the spirit in which you engage with it. Because when people question your integrity or, you know, your intentions, it's very different from having a respectful disagreement. And so there are some debates where people had very furious disagreements with me, but they would still, you know, engage respectfully and have fun. And I like to crack jokes at my own expense, so that always helps.
At least you've got a sense of humour about it. Well, look, you served as the Australian Rights Commissioner between February 2014 and February 2016. And in that role, you faced probably some of your bigger obstacles. You were appointed by Tony Abbott for that, weren't you?
I was Human Rights Commissioner. I was the first major appointment of the Abbott government. And that was interesting because, you know, there were lots of people who, you know, criticised my appointment, which again didn't really bother me. But one of the ones that criticised it very strongly was the Australian Christian Lobby, whereas, of course, Australians for Marriage Equality welcomed it. But there were people who had lots of different views because I'm very hard line on free speech and always have been. That's been a long-standing position of mine. And that leads people, continues to be a contentious issue. And so it can draw some pretty harsh views from people.
What did you get done in that role?
So a lot of what ultimately was delivered in terms of marriage equality was a big part of what I was doing. A lot of what I did is still being played out because it's a job that has long-term consequences. You don't have any power. You can't do that. Mm. It doesn't just happen like that. Everything you do has to go to the parliament. So I did a lot of work around native title reform, which is still ongoing to help Indigenous Australians use their land. There was a conversation I started, which was actually about what religious freedom means in society today. Mm. And everybody kind of said, this is obscure. And I said, no, this is going to be big. And we need to start preparing and having a sensible discussion. Because if you don't, you'll have a very unsensible or irresponsible conversation.
What personally do you want to see happen with the protection of religious freedoms?
So I don't have a clear answer on this because religious freedom is the idea of religious freedom is a sort of like a package of rights and freedoms. So freedom of speech, freedom of association, property rights are part of it, you know, what you can do on different grounds, those sorts of things. And so where are the weaknesses? There is some weakness where under federal anti-discrimination law you can discriminate against anybody. You can't discriminate against anybody on pretty much any grounds, but religion actually isn't covered, whereas it is in most state laws. There's some balancing between, I think, some imbalances in some current laws, for instance, around freedom of speech, where, say, for instance, advocating a traditional view of what marriage, well, let's say what was once a traditional view anyway, of marriage between a man and a woman is still the position that's held within the Bible and some people hold dear, and it doesn't matter what the law says in Australia, can be seen to offend people on the basis of their sexual orientation or gender identity. Now, they should have every right to hold on to that view, as much as we had the right to have a different view when their view was the law. And so I think we have to get a lot of those how those laws are designed balanced correctly. But do I think we need to then go in and say, no, there's some sort of special rights and privileges for people just because they have faith? No, that's a different thing. And that's what the Ruddock Review is looking at, because you can't have protection of rights kind of in isolation. It's not how human rights work. They're always balanced against other competing rights. And if you start saying, well, we know we've got to protect religious liberty in its own right, then you have to do it for everyone else. Then you get a Bill of Rights. Now, I'm against the Bill of Rights. Other people before. But for Australia to introduce a Bill of Rights would dramatically and profoundly change our country in a way that's much more serious than this committee is set up to consider.
What are the ramifications of that?
Well, when you set up bills of rights and the like, if depending on how much teeth you give them, and that can vary, you establish very clear principles in law which must become quarantined. So everybody says they're in favour of human rights, and I had this when I was Human Rights Commissioner, people saying, you should have a Bill of Rights. Okay, so you're happy if you have a Bill of Rights with a very strong protection of freedom of speech. And people would say, yes, that's right. And I said, okay, well, so Section 18C, the Racial Discrimination Act, which makes it unlawful to offend somebody, that would be on base race, that's gone. There's no way that could stand. Plain packaging of tobacco products would have to go as an example. Now, you know, in the US, their strong protection of freedom of speech won't even allow graphic warning labels on tobacco products or the compulsory use of it. So that's what you get. You start getting principles overriding what the parliament can do if you go with one with teeth. Even if you don't go with one with as much teeth, which is what we've got in Victoria, you still allow courts to then start to decide public policy questions, and then we become a less democratic society. And funnily enough, what has all the conversation been, particularly during the debate around marriage equality, but then since then, we now have a formal independent inquiry looking at religious freedom, because it's part of where does religion sit in a pluralistic or a diverse society where everybody else's identity is respected, and what is faith? Because many people see faith as solely something of choice, but it's not. It's much more complex than that. It goes to the heart of people's culture and their place in the world, and of course, I'm absent faith, but I can see how it's core to some people's identity. And so there are a lot of conversations that have started, but it can only be finished with the federal parliament, which is part of the reason why I got so frustrated and got out, is because if you're not in the federal parliament, you're starting these conversations, but you can't finish them.
Some people said that there was some definite failures on your behalf, but I don't want to talk about it.
I'm quite happy to. Well, I don't know what those failures are.
Well, I don't really feel that necessary to go into the failures, because for me personally, I think, what are your lessons learnt? Like, was there something that you walked away from those roles and felt like you could have done better?
You can always do things better, but I mean, it was an enormously tense environment to work in where people have difference of opinion. Now, one of the things I often had thrown at me was I didn't do enough work on asylum seekers, which firstly is not true. And secondly, there was an agreement when I got to the commission between the president of the commission and myself, she would take responsibility for asylum seekers. Now, I probably should have just publicised that a lot more, because people said, oh, you didn't do any work on asylum seekers. Well, actually, I did, and here's all the work that I did. But then on top of that, you know, we came to an agreement to divide that responsibility and let her do it rather than us have constant fights about whose job it was. And so I think most of the complaints are actually based on people's ignorance. But what did I learn? I guess, again, it taught me you've got to stand up very forcefully, and that a lot of the most important conversations in this nation are hard. And you've got to be prepared to fight when it's easy and when it's hard. And you've got to sometimes be prepared to have your own community or communities who support you criticise you from time to time and tell them that, you know, this is why I think I'm doing this and I think it's right. And my view is that on all of the issues that I worked on, all of them have actually proven to be right. The big task is making sure you take people along with you.
In 2016, you were pre-selected as the Liberal candidate for the seat of Goldstein. Do you reckon that's probably what you're most proud of?
I'm never proud of holding office or longevity in office. I'm only proud of outcomes. And so it was an enormous stepping stone, because I took a huge risk to get there. It paid off. And one of the things about politics is you've got a certain amount of political capital, and if you bet it all on black and you lose all the capital, you win, you double it. It's like roulette. And so, of course, I was very proud to be able to represent that community. That was a community I wanted to represent. It's a community the best my values align with in the nation, and I have the best community in the country to represent. And then I went on to then get the best result electorally in the seat's history, which there's no dispute is something that you can be proud of as well.
Absolutely.
But it's not about getting influence or positions, it's what you do with them. So since then, there's been quite a lot that some of it, marriage equality is obviously a very high profile thing, but there are a lot of other debates where I've actually had a profound impact. Even within my first 18 months, you know, I stopped an extradition treaty with others with China, which I'm very proud of. I had a lot of influence over different debates in the parliament around free speech, and now I'm starting to move on to tax reform. So nobody would say I'm a shy retiring flower. I haven't had an influence in 18 months.
Well, I think looking back over some of the things in your career, you were quite passionate about safe schools. What do you think of safe schools now that it's sort of been under fire so many times?
Well, so I was on the steering committee of safe schools, and safe schools was a program designed obviously to deal with anti-bullying, but it was also a program to help teachers who, you know, went through the education system like 30, some cases 50 years ago, and these sorts of topics weren't really kind of discussed, and they needed upskilling. But now, and it went through a period where I would argue it was basically hijacked by particularly one individual to drive their own socio-political agenda. Now, whatever anybody thinks about that socio-political agenda, that isn't the purpose of the program. It's to try and build a sense of empathy and understanding amongst young people and amongst teachers, so that kids who, you know, deal with sexuality or gender identity issues, don't face bullying, are safe and get the support they need, because sometimes, as you know, they may not be getting home. The truth is, I think it's lost a lot of social license, and I don't think it enjoys the credibility it needs for some of the issues it deals with. And, you know, the current state opposition has said if they're elected, they'd abolish the program and replace it with something that's broad-based, covering anti-bullying, but can still have streams that focus on specific issues, whether it's sexual orientation or gender or anything else. And I think that's a way to rebuild public confidence, so that LGBTI kids are protected, but also that all kids are protected.
It just needs to be now repackaged, I think. You know, I feel like there's some definite tools that are there that need to be there for teachers to rely on if they don't know how to be a good teacher in a classroom to a child, if they think that they are an LGBTI kid with their training wheels on.
Putting it politely, I think half the reason that a lot of the program ended up where it did with the criticism it got was actually because it was run by straight people who don't actually get the sensitivities around some of these issues, and they are caught up in, and I say it with love and respect, you know, all caught up in wanting to, you know, wrap around the rainbow flag and look all very progressive and forward thinking.
Without knowing.
Without actually understanding that LGBTI people actually get the sensitivities around issues and how things can be presented. And they didn't.
It was so weird that Safe Schools was used against us throughout the marriage equality campaign. But, you know,
I disagree, because I think a lot of people who are running campaigns against.
But it was exactly what they were trying to do. They were trying to say that teachers were going to be teaching kids in school about dildos. Like, you know, that wasn't going to happen.
that's not going
to
happen.
They were sensationalising things to use it against us.
Of course, but, you know, that always happens to a certain extent. But it's actually quite rude towards teachers. Because the idea that teachers are going to somehow adopt these practices is absurd. And, you know, I mean, teachers go into school to teach kids, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic and everything else. And the idea that they were going to be comfortable doing this is just childish, frankly.
If you're looking back at that change to the law that John Howard made when he was in power, just how quickly that they changed that law.
Yeah.
You know, it's Phil Ruddock that changed it. Like, do you think that seemed unfair to change the law that way?
No, I'm going to be contrarian on this. It was the right decision at the time. Actually, I think what Howard did was really good, because it laid down the marker and said, firstly, the Parliament has the choice to decide this, and then we're saying no, but of course any future Parliament can then change it.
But why didn't they just have why didn't they ask for a plebiscite back then to change that?
Because it's always been the reserve of the federal Parliament to make these decisions, and no one's ever disputed that. It's the mechanism we get there. And the Howard government said, this is how the law has always been interpreted. And that was true. Mm-hmm. And this is where the Australian community is at, and it's true. And that was obviously his personal view as well, and I'm not disputing that as well. And so they said, we're going to clarify the law so that we don't go off and have all these legal disputes, because in the end, it was not desirable for us to become, the LGBTI community, for it to become a legal issue. In fact, the big mistake Howard made was then to put in the law that the civil celebrant had to read out that marriage is a union between the man and woman to the exclusion of all others, if you remember that phrase, which was regularly repeated for a decade, because it came a point of protest. You know, you go to a wedding and the, you know, civil celebrant would say, I have to legally say these words, but the bride and groom want to express blah, blah, particularly in the last 5 years. And so it became this constant point of reminder that the law was discriminatory. I think it was a massive fail on his part. It actually backfired significantly, because in the long run, it rallied people rather than the reverse. Whereas, because the first bit of public support where we got majority support for marriage equality didn't occur till 2007, but that was still only a marginal base of support, and it's grown since then. So we didn't need a plebiscite this time. We know that. But once it was promised, some people were very strongly wedded to it for lots of different reasons, pardon the pun. And the reality was, once it was promised, it was going to happen.
What personally do you want to see? So where is it that you ultimately want to go with your career? You can tell me.
Just you. There's nobody else
I'm talking
to.
No one else is listening.
So I have a short, a medium, and a long-term plan. My short-term plan was to deal with the immediate issues of marriage equality. So I can say, check, so I'm a third of the way there. Next one is tax reform, and because I think the tax system is fundamentally unjust and harms particularly young people. Not just young people, but it's skewed unfairly and doesn't reflect the world we live in today. And then longer term, my interest in health policy, because if you look at the policy area that has the greatest intersection of human outcomes, budgetary impacts, the role of technology, exportable industry, you know, blah, 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 health is the biggest one. And I think it's the most interesting, and it's technically very interesting.
In 10 years' time, if you look at the title, though, for what your title would be, would you be disappointed if you didn't have a certain title? Like, you're looking forward to the future and thinking, oh, I'd like to be this person.
Well, I'm a person who always believes the future is going to be awesome, but I'm more interested, as I said before, in outcomes than I am in titles. You know, let's not kid ourselves. Everyone who goes into the federal parliament...
Do you want to be prime minister at some point?
Yeah, I was about to say, everyone who goes to federal parliament, you know, dreams about glory and would love to, you know, is lying to the public if they don't say, yeah, of course I'd love to be prime minister. Of course I'd love to be this. But it's about why. And that's why I stress I'm only interested in positions to achieve outcomes. my ambition is for the country, the community, and the community I serve, and the people of Australia as much as for myself.
Before we wrap this up, just talking about the LGBTI landscapes, you know, we've been on a real journey with our place with the plebiscite and fighting for marriage equality. Yes. You know, what are the obstacles that we face now?
Well, there are lots of things that have kind of been gone under the radar that have been ignored as a consequence of this obsession with marriage equality. And it's not to say it shouldn't have been done, but, you know, issues around trans health, lesbian health. Lesbian health is massively underpaid attention to. There's obviously a lot of focus on gay men health, particularly as a consequence of the legacy of HIV AIDS and STIs. And not that it don't affect lesbians and women too, but there probably hasn't been enough focus on some of those issues. But, you know, law is only one instrument of social acceptance. There's still a lot of cultural acceptance. There's still a lot of outreach that needs to be done with other communities who may still have reservations about people who are in, you know, same-sex attracted, for instance. There's obviously still a big piece around social acceptance of intolerance of people on the basis of gender identity. And I think, and you know, that's just here. Let's look at the global situation. You know, just in the past 48 hours, the Indonesian province of Aceh is considering, you know, it was 5-year jail terms, I think it is, for people if they're homosexual. You still have horrific crimes being committed against people, particularly in the Middle East, where there's sort of different models of Sharia law being implemented. And I think it's time, you know, a lot of violence against women, including and LGBTI people in the Pacific Islands. I think it's time that some of us started stop thinking just about, you know, the issues that affect us and started thinking about the issues that affect our neighbours as well, because a lot of the backlash that's happening in some countries is as a consequence of the progress or being influenced by the progress in Western countries. If you look at the rhetoric of a lot of those who attack LGBTI people in, say, East Africa or the Middle East or the Pacific Islands or parts of Southeast Asia, it's often, you know, see, if you let them live their lives and let them without interference, you know, eventually they'll push for marriage and they'll get it. And so it's built in a cultural, religious intolerance that is kind of a very direct consequence of the progress that we've made.
For the people out there that are still suffering their no vote, did you have a message for those people?
Most of them saw the results and said, okay, we lost, and we lost comprehensively. But obviously, there's just nothing to fear. I mean,
what about all the crap that they were saying? They're like, oh, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. None of it would actually happen.
Well, none of it's happened. And so I think they've got to reflect on their leaders and the people who led them down that garden path and say, well, they didn't tell me the truth on this. Now maybe I should question other things they say and let's look at things objectively and honestly. But we shouldn't dismiss it. Some people had like genuine fears. And now whether we agree with them or not, or whether they were well-founded or not, there were genuine fears. But I think we also as a community need to be upstanding enough to see that if any of those fears are realised, sometimes we've got to call out people within our own community and say, hey, that's not how we behave.
Have you ever been out to dinner with Kevin Andrews, though, and had a discussion about his adverse opinion to yours?
We've had discussions about it, but, you know, when we go cycling together.
You go cycling.
No, I'm just teasing. No, but there's a whole, that interview where he talked about cycling
yeah,
buddies.
Yeah, I know.
No. No, not recently, but, you know, I have with lots of other people, and you know, you just have a different worldview, and they're entitled to it, and their view won't change and my view won't change, and they chose the platform on which we fought and they lost. So most of them, also pretty much everybody's accepted it. It's just, it is what it is. I'm just surprised they wanted to lose on a platform so badly, but I think there was, because I gave a speech about this, so it's not like I'm saying this the first time. The people who have something to fear from a plebiscite aren't the people who win, they're the people who lose. So why would you, and if you actually understand, and that's a big question some people probably didn't understand, if you didn't understand that you're going to lose, why on earth would you pick this battlefield?
I think because they thought they were going to win.
Yes, I think that's right. But
I don't think anyone picks a battle to try and lose.
No, I think that's right, but I think it was, let's just say that it's one of the reasons why I was very, didn't agree with the way a lot of the LGBTI community responded to the proposal of plebiscite. While I disagreed with it, in the end, we were always going to win it. And it was like, this is our chance. Grab it. Because there's this assumption that if we just sat around and waited, it was going to happen. It's just crap. There's just some, I know that that might be desirable and you think that the forces and the planets will align. In politics, opportunities present themselves and you grab them when you can to affect the change when you want, because you never know when the next one's going to come along. We could have had, you know, another country attack us. I mean, say that. And the focus just shifts. And, you know, all of a sudden it's like, okay, so we're trying to defend the nation and you're obsessed about your interest in getting married. And then it goes off the radar.
It's funny, though, when you think about the way we fought for equality. We changed to equality as averse to talking about the sex or talking about, you know, you used to see the rallies where they were quite sexualized with, you know, people would have placards that were quite sexualized. And then all of a sudden we started talking about equality and they seemed to go away. Do you think that was an interesting shift?
Firstly, the gay community is a lot more conservative than it used to be.
Why do you think that is?
Mainstreamness. Seeking much greater social acceptance.
People back then were facing such strong adversity to the sexuality, which meant that they pushed forward and rebelled and they were like, well, I'm going to shove who I am in your face.
Because they were fighting against decriminalisation. They were fighting for decriminalisation, for instance. And it was about, but what we've come to realise as a successful strategy is not point of difference, but sameness. It's like, yeah, right, so my partner's a bloke or my partner's a Sheila or whatever it is. But actually, I still get up out of bed, have breakfast, turn on sunrise, brush my teeth, have a shower, go to work. And my life is actually just exactly like yours. And by building that sense of, you know, if you ever want to convince somebody, you don't start by points of difference. You start by trying to build this affinity of sameness, which then leads to people realizing the commonality and sharing the journey with you.
Do you have a message for the queer community out there listening to this right now?
Like, firstly, rock on. Great result last year. But hard things have to be sacrificed for, and it's hard. You're never going to get anything on a silver platter, but I'd go back to what I said before, which is don't forget the people overseas who have never experienced the freedom that you have or even the inkling of it and still live in life of terror and fear, and that we have a responsibility to take care of ourselves, but we have a responsibility to take and support people who can't support themselves.
Tim Wilson, this is Word for Word. I want to thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Benjamin.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Benjamin Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.